Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. This is my friend Brent Johnson, the man behind the Dollar Milkshake Theory. If you're unfamiliar with what that is, can't quite wrap your head around the name of the podcast, then please visit our YouTube channel. There's a playlist at the top that says Start Here. It'll take you down that rabbit hole, explain what the Dollar Milkshake Theory is, and give you better context around some of the, I guess, core views and perspectives we have about financial markets. Brent, it was, wow, what a week, right? So it's a lot of macro, a lot of data, a lot of volatility. I guess it's a lot of the things that you kind of expect it would start to happen at this time of the year.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks, so, you know, we kind of made a low last week. We bounced higher this week. And now, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see where we go from here. I was talking to a couple of clients late last week or the beginning of this week, and I kind of made the comment that while we're not at the same levels, we're kind of in the same place as we were a year ago. And what I mean by that is, you know, a year ago at this time, things, you know, the equities were at their low, VIX was at their high. We had numerous central banks around the world intervening to kind of save the markets, you know, in England, in Japan, China. And that was a point where things were either going to break down pretty hard or they were going to get better, but they weren't going to go sideways. And I kind of feel like we're kind of in that same place right now again. I don't think markets are going to go sideways. They may go violently sideways, but I don't think we're just going to have just a humdrum rest of the fourth quarter here. I think we're at a place where either things are going to start to break down or we're going to get some kind of a change in policy or something, which then sends the market higher. But I don't, I think we're at the inflection point now where we're either going to get some fireworks one way or the other. So it's going to be interesting to see which way it goes.
Yeah, well, let's look at some of the data that, you know, kind of played into that narrative. The biggest one probably, perhaps where we should start would be the non-farm payroll. This is, I don't know how to get my head around this sometimes because I feel like so much emphasis is put on employment data for obvious reasons, but I can't quite figure out why we're still using these blurry data sets, these surveys. It feels like part of the reason is the government can manipulate the data to kind of create the narrative they want, but we had a huge beat and we talked about going into the non-farm payroll, you know, potentially what the data would mean in terms of Fed policy, because so much of what goes on in markets is expectations driven. I proposed the question to you like, hey, the expectations are lower than normal. So even if we have just a small beat, it was 170, if we have 180, hey Brent, do you think, is that going to spur a certain type of reactions because it exceeded expectations? Well, forget all that because it nearly tripled expectations with 336,000 jobs added. And of course, as you look underneath the headline number a little bit, you see full-time workers was actually down and it was an explosion of part-time workers. So how do you think the market, did they appropriately digest the information? And what's your overall take just on non-farm payroll, the way they approach it? And where do you kind of see the employment sector at the moment?
Well, I think the way I'd say is it's still okay. You know, we've talked numerous times this week that we think at some point we're going to hit the wall, right? But so far we haven't. And you know, there's been numerous prognosticators out there saying, oh, this is, we're going to hit it now. Oh, we're going to hit it now. Oh, we're going to hit it now. And we just haven't hit it yet. And that's kind of where I'm at right now is, you know, again, this was a good jobs number. The headline was a fantastic jobs number. But as you said, when you look underneath it, it's not quite as good. And in fact, you could argue it's getting worse. But it wasn't a horrible jobs number either. So it wasn't it wasn't something where, you know, we're expecting 180 and we get 30 or something. So, you know, we're expecting 180, we got 330. Even if you cut that in half, you get to 160 or whatever it is, or 170. That's pretty much in line with what the expectation was, right? And so, you know, I think The reason it's important, and the funny thing, remember last week we were saying we weren't even sure if we were going to get this data because there was a government shutdown looming. Of course, they come in at the last minute. They pass this, bill, and the government stays open, and we get the data. And so, you know, it's really important now because we still have a potential another or potentially even two more rate hikes ahead of us. You know, instead of hiking and saying we're done, the Fed said, well, we're not going to hike, but there may be more. And so it makes every little piece of data that comes out important because everybody's reading the tea leaves to see what does it mean for interest rates. And so, you know, it was really interesting to me because it was a huge beat. And of course, markets sold off initially. But even though they sold off hard initially, they didn't crash. I mean, they weren't down like 2% or 3%. I think they were down 1%. That's not nothing. It's not like a huge, scary waterfall. And I think as people started to kind of read through and look at more of the, underneath the hood, as you said, you realize it's a lot of part-time workers, not nearly as many full-time workers. And so then the markets, they stopped falling, but they just kind of stayed low for an hour or two. And then kind of out of the blue, they just rallied on a dime. And I'm not sure what was said or done that made them rally on a dime. It's hard for me to believe that everybody came to the conclusion or read through the minutes and looked at the actual data at the exact same time. But the mood shifted. And, you know, by the end of the day, markets were, you know, up 1%. So, you know, not only had they risen 1% to get back to even, then they rose another 1% on top of it. So I think the NASDAQ had a 2 to 3% intraday move. The Dow had a 2% intraday move, similar with the S&P. And so now I think we're kind of in the same place we were a week ago. Now we got to see, you know, we've got data coming out this week that'll be important and that'll be watched really closely. And so, you know, this is the problem with the Fed saying, we're not sure yet we're doing to be data dependent, is because then every piece of data becomes more important. And maybe each individual piece of data is not important, but if you get, you know, a streak of data that either bodes hawkish or dovish, then you can get a move out of there.
Well, we've had quite a bit of data, data that many people are trying to find a way to kind of fit into their storyline. And I think the storyline has been that, you know, rate hikes lead to something breaking, recession, soft landing is out of the question. I don't want to quite go down the tangent yet of the point you've been making lately, which is perhaps people should be thinking or accepting the reality that maybe that's what the Fed wants. But the data certainly is telling this 2007-2000 story, which I still don't quite know what exactly that's saying. I mean, we all know what happened. You know, you had the dot-com in early 2000s, and then of course the great financial crisis, but you have treasury yields up to levels not seen since 2001. I'm just looking at some of the stuff here. You have the 30-year treasury yield is above 5% for the first time since 2007. 30-year mortgage rates are above 7.5%, the highest level since 2000. So there's clearly some extremes here, especially when you consider the percentile of the change, the move, when you had, you know, the 30-year below 1%, you had mortgage rates below 3%, and you had, you know, the shorter duration bonds basically at zero. So when you're looking at some of this data, I mean, you're saying the Fed's data dependent. We get that. That's kind of why there's so much sensitivity to all the data points. Do you contribute or attribute any of this, like, since 2007 type of label that people are putting on? Does this mean anything to you?
I mean, sort of. The reason everything is different now is because we've come from such a different place. I mean, it's when people look 30 years ago, when people look back at the last 2 years, they're going to say, holy. Rates went from 0 to 5.5% in 18 months. That's an enormous move. And if you go from 5.5 to 10.5, that's not as big a deal as going from 0 to 5.5. I mean, it's enormous. It really is. It really is historic what we're seeing. And it's the simple fact that I mean, think about this. You could have started your career. You could have graduated college in 1982, started your career in 1983, been a grunt for 2 or 3 years, you know, finally got, you know, kind of got out of the analyst role, started to have a little bit of responsibility, had the 1987 panic, and then from there had a bull market for the most part in equities, and interest rates only went down for the next 30 years or 25 years. So you could have had a 25-year career, made millions of dollars for yourself, for your clients. Everybody could tell you, you know, how smart you were and how successful you were. And there was many pieces of evidence that you could look at that would back that statement up. But yet you have never seen anything like you've seen in the last 18 months. And so while it's kind of interesting to say not since 2007, it's really not since ever. I mean, this is really kind of unprecedented, right? And especially for people on bond desks who have never seen interest rates rise. And, you know, I think Russell Napier said it best a couple of years ago when he said all fixed income desks should fire everybody they have and go hire emerging market analysts, because only in emerging markets, only emerging market bond desks are familiar with rising interest rates and how to manage it. Nobody in the West is used to doing that. And I thought that was a pretty prescient observation by him. And so, you know, I think what we have seen over the last couple weeks, and this is my take, and perhaps this is wrong, but I think last year, equity markets came to terms with inflation and higher rates. And then as interest rates were expected to peak this year and then have it, and the Fed was going to slow down and then it wouldn't be too much longer before the rate cuts started coming, equities started rallying on that thought. And while rates went up last year on the front end, the yield curve was steeper a year ago, meaning the long end didn't rise as fast last year as it's rising this year. Or maybe a better way to say it, because I mathematically, I'm not sure if what I just said is actually true. But what I think we've seen in the last couple of weeks, or especially in the last couple of months, is that the long end of the market is coming to terms with higher for longer. And I think that has been a surprise for both equity investors and long-term bond holders over the last couple, call it months. And that is why you've seen these dramatic drop in bond prices and dramatic rise in yields. And here's the thing, and this is the point that I've tried to make to a number of people who tell me that the Fed must hate that long-term bond yields are rising. This is horrible for the United States. Well, sort of. I mean, clearly we have budget issues. Nobody can deny that. But the Fed does not want front-end rates at 7% and long-end rates at 0, because that would not just indicate we have a recession ahead. That would indicate that the entire world economy is collapsing, right? And we've said numerous times that while they want to slow the market down, they don't want to break the entire world and have the whole thing come crashing down in a complete, you know, global meltdown. Maybe they want a controlled demolition, but they don't want a global meltdown. And as yields rise on the long end, that inverted yield curve, which everybody knows always eventually leads to recession, starts to flatten out. And that's what we've seen this year. We've seen the flattening of the yield curve as the long end rises. And a flattening yield curve is actually better long term than a dramatically inverted one. So while on the one hand, yes, it means that it's going to affect budgetary issues for the United States, and that will have huge implications for the entire global economy, it also indicates that long-term yields are rising for the U.S. because they can, because things aren't as bad as a global collapse would indicate from a inverted yield curve. And the idea that long-term rates rising in the United States is uniquely bad for the United States and doesn't affect the rest of the world, it is just wrong. It just is. We are not going to have a situation where the United States cannot fund itself, but India can fund itself and Japan can fund itself and UK can fund itself. I mean, this idea that the US is the only one in the situation and everybody else is going to be fine. The world is way too interconnected for that to exist. And so on the one hand, while the budgetary impacts of higher yields are definitely going to make challenges for the United States, it's going to make enormous challenges for the rest of the world as well, because everything in the world is priced off of the 10-year treasury. I mean, that is, I don't care what, I know people hate it when they hear this word risk-free rate, but that is the risk-free rate, and that risk-free rate is rising. And as yields go higher, it has dramatic impacts for a number of different asset classes. As yields rise, if you do a discounted cash flow analysis, now you are dividing by a bigger number. And when you divide by a bigger number, you get a smaller valuation. So that has an impact in market prices. And this is why the Fed is doing it. This is why the Fed wants higher rates, because this is the way they bring down asset prices and slow down the economy, and as a result, bring down inflation. So as interest rates go up, you discount cash flows at a bigger number, you get a lower valuation. At the same time, as interest rates go up, fixed income prices, bond prices fall. Well, guess what the biggest source of collateral in the world is? U.S. Treasuries. So as U.S. Treasuries fall, the collateral off of which new loans can be made, which is the entire system, you know, the entire system runs off new loans being made. As the collateral value falls, less loans can be made. So you can't have the same number of lending going on, even if people wanted to. And as a result, you get a slowing down of the economy. So again, the idea that the Fed is beside themselves because long-term yields are rising, I just don't think it's the case. And I think the Fed understands this. I don't think they're a bunch of geniuses, but I don't think they're the idiots that everybody else thinks that they are either. And this is largely what I think they want. And I think the last couple weeks is in many ways the market coming to terms with the fact that what Jay Powell has been saying is actually what he means. I think a lot of people thought that he didn't mean what he was saying, and I think they're slowly realizing that he does mean what he says.
So the dollar is up 12 weeks in a row, and yeah. we shared a clip from last week's episode where we did a little bit of a teaser about the U.S. dollar kind of already acting as a CBDC. But one of the things that we kind of extrapolated in that episode and in that particular clip was the idea of kind of the difference between in the roles that the bond plays and the dollar itself. They're intertwined, but they are somewhat different. And, you know, mentioning that the dollar has been up 12 weeks in a row, you know, these higher yields, it's attracting more capital to the US, which puts pressure on other currencies, other bond markets, etc. But one of the arguments that was kind of made this week, because the move in the long end, it wasn't so much that, hey, look, you know, we're at this 2001, 2007, level, is how quick we move there this week. I think the 30-year had like a 50 basis point move. I might be slightly wrong on that, but it was a big move. So the question that started to get proposed, or like the conversation that was fun, especially for, you know, the end of the world dollar type people, is this is the global stage rejecting, you know, treasury, the pristine collateral as the pristine collateral. And you had mentioned, you know, as far as like when the collateral becomes more expensive, or the yield or the cost becomes, the interest rate becomes higher, the bond's obviously going to be lower, but the lending of that becomes more complicated. And you're seeing that. So the slowdown's starting to show up, where we saw dramatic collapse in new loan growth from the banking sector. So I don't want to go back on what we kind of dove into last week, but you have the dollar just keeps going 12-week high. This is really aggravating a lot of people. You've had a huge move in the long duration bonds. You just kind of talked about some of the reasoning behind that, but do you want to address this idea that this is, you know, the global market rejecting the U.S. Treasury market as the collateral?
Well, I just think it's very, very apropos, funny, ironic, however you want to label this, that, you know, it wasn't that long ago, John, 6 months ago, where the BRICS were going to take over the world, de-dollarization was all the rage, you know, the world was rejecting the dollar. It was very clear by the fact that it had gone from 115 to 100. And the BRICS meeting in August was going to be the cherry on top. And, you know, DXY was headed to 88. And then six, you know, weeks later went past and the dollar was up. And another 6 weeks later, the dollar went up. And now all of a sudden, well, yeah, the dollar's up, but the bonds aren't. So now, you know, talk about moving your goalposts. You know, you're moving from the, now the, yeah, the dollar might be strong, but the bonds are really bad. And listen, this is the biggest bonds, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, one of the biggest bond sales off in history. I mean, this is historic. I'm not denying that, but it's, when you consider the actions that the Fed has taken, it's really not that surprising. And again, part of the reason that yields are higher in the United States are because they can be, because we do sit at the center of the world, because there is so much demand for U.S. assets, U.S. dollar assets, treasury bonds. We can have higher yields because our economy and our place in the world allows us to pay higher yields. How can we do this forever? Of course not. Is it going to impact our budget? Of course. Is that going to have some negative ramifications? Absolutely, yes. But when you look around the world, you know, consider the fact that we are still raising rates, or at least we haven't started cutting them. We're still talking about doing it a few more times. Meanwhile, many places around the world are starting to say, I don't know if we can raise rates anymore. And, you know, they're starting to punt on that. So again, it's kind of not surprising me that, you know, the dollar fatalists have moved on to the bond fatalists, you know, and then when the bonds have a rally, then they'll move on from that and they'll say, yeah, but our political system's a mess, you know, and they'll just keep rotating around and around until they realize that all the rest of the world is in a worse shape than we are. And so, yeah, that's kind of where we're at with that.
I saw that Peru, for the second time in a row, cut rates. So back to your point, you know, there's starting to be these knock-on effects in these smaller emerging markets, and even, you know, developed markets are now starting to struggle with this dollar strength and the higher interest rates in the U.S., particularly if the Fed stands behind its messaging of higher for longer. But one of the most critical markets and most popular to watch when these things start to kind of fall apart at the seams is Japan. And we had a very interesting move in the yen this week. And, you know, there's always a bit of a question mark about what Japan can and cannot do. They've been doing yield curve control forever. What are your thoughts on this move in the yen? You know, there's a certain Rubicon. Once it gets to, generally speaking, the 150 mark, things start to get dicey. And historically, I believe the BOJ kind of steps in. They didn't make any formal announcement. Maybe they did after the fact, not that I know of, but there was a huge drop in the yen right around it teasing that level. So what are your thoughts on what drove that? And do you think this was intervention?
Yeah, I think it was intervention. And possibly there was, you know, and the reason when you get to these types of levels, what probably happened is there was probably somebody out there who thought, okay, you know, the yen went to 150 last year and then it backed off. And this year, when we get back to 150, if it breaks through 150, it's going to go to 170 very quickly, right? So they probably had some calls. There was probably a big trade out there around 150, 151 on the yen, a big call position. And as it got there, or maybe they even had a short position on, and maybe they had a limit price. When it gets to 151, sell a ton of it, right? And, you know, when it gets there, and then, but that's also the area where the Bank of Japan's going to come in and intervene and try to save it. And so, you know, whether it was a big option position that got taken out or a big short position that got taken out, that, again, this is why central banks intervene. They want to scare the crap out of the market. They want to scare the hell out of the bond vigilantes or the currency vigilantes, and say, don't mess with us because we're bigger than you are. And that makes them question doing it again. But eventually the markets overpower the central banks and it all ends up going that way. So, you know, the bottom line is that the yen has fallen for several weeks. The dollar has rallied for several weeks. There is at some point going, even if this trend continues, at some point there's going to be a reverse trend, right? There's going to be a counter trend rally. Now, does that happen? And the same thing with the treasury bonds. I think one of the potentially most dangerous trades is going to happen in the next 3 months. And it's going to happen with the dollar. It's going to happen with the yen. It's going to happen with the bonds. And that is, there's going to be a counter trend rally. I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know how far it will go. And I don't know how long it will last. But what could potentially happen is we could see another pullback in the dollar. We could see a run in the yen. We could see bonds actually get a bounce and yields come down a little bit because for whatever reason, they think the Fed is done, right? And if the Fed is done, the dollar is going to pull off. If the dollar pulls off and the Bank of Japan helps out the yen's going to run. As the dollar pulls off because yields are coming down, then bonds are going to rally. And then maybe people think the whole move is over. And then the counter trend, and people start loading up that way. And then the counter trend rally, fizzles out, and you slingshot back the other way. So that's the hard thing with markets is they don't go in a straight line. And it's really hard to keep your conviction when something goes against your heart, especially if you have a big position. So I think the next 3 or 4 months are going to be fascinating. I think they're not going to be boring. I think they're going to be great volatility. I think there's probably going to be a couple people taken out on stretchers before it's all said and done. But this is kind of where we're at now. We've kicked the can down the road so long and for so far that the ramifications are going to start taking place. And, you know, I don't think that we're going to have the next two. If we take out last year, if we look from post-COVID to beginning of 2022, you know, so for 18 to 24 months, we had very little volatility and asset prices up and to the right. Maybe asset prices continue to go up and to the right, but it's not going to be in a straight line. I don't think we're going to keep VIX below 15. I don't think we're going to keep, bond volatility and currency volatility low. And nothing's going to go in a straight line, but I think the big game is kicking off. Is maybe the right way to say it.
The big game. All right. Well, we'll see. We had a couple weeks ago now, I think, we did a WWJD segment. That's What Would Johnson Do? If you're somewhat new to the show, you'll see on our YouTube homepage, we break everything into segments, very specific kind of approach in each one of those videos. They all have unique thumbnails. So in that type of segment, we present to Brent here a one or the other, what would you kind of do? And we in that segment kind of got into if Brent was given the power to be a central banker. And we did talk quite a bit about gold. There are some interesting things that are going on right now in the gold market. And just as a teaser, we might potentially have an interesting guest coming up that loves the topic of gold. So for now, I think we hold off on moving into gold in relevance to some of the things you're talking about. But an equally interesting commodity at the moment that falls in line with, you know, how the economy is performing, and certainly this idea that there's kind of a trend reversal, at least temporarily. We saw oil make some really big run-ups in the last couple of weeks. You and I were talking before the cameras went on, I had shared with you, you know, for me sitting from the bleachers, it looked pretty obvious that there was a lot of room for a pullback in oil given all the enthusiasm and euphoria and certainly how quick the move happened. You being, you know, on the playing field, you had the courage to actually put, you know, money where your mouth is. You made an oil bet. You've had some success with that. So I want you to share with us a little bit about that. But at the same time, as we're recording this, within the last probably 12 hours, we've had a dramatic terrorist attack in Israel from the Hamas. And, you know, one of the questions I have for you, because I think getting under the hood of what that really means geopolitically is better saved for another segment that we do called the Madness Edition, where we get a bit more political. But instead, I'd rather focus on your oil trade, how it coincides with some of these things that you're seeing going on in the economy, and where you potentially think the oil markets overall and the economy overall starts to react to this event, because it does feel like a very, very like tense geopolitical moment where people are going to start to pick sides.
Yeah, so I mean, the oil trade's probably been one of our best trades this year. Again, you got to understand, me shorting oil a couple weeks ago, unless you can go back and look at it. I sold oil. We sold futures short at, I want to say, like $89.90. It was just below $90. And a few days later, we bought put options on Exxon. And it was just our belief in the short term that that oil had made a huge run. Sentiment was really stretched. We thought it was possible that, you know, I think a lot of people were expecting production to get cut. We were thinking that production, that Saudi Arabia might increase production. And we, it's funny because we heard on late Friday after the markets closed that Saudi Arabia was considering increasing production. Well, I'll come back to that in a second. But anyway, over the last week, as, you know, kind of this stuff started to come out, you know, oil pulled back $10. I think, you know, the oil trade went against us initially. You know, we sold it around 90. It went as high as 93. It might have only gone to 94. It went against us initially. When it went against us, we bought more puts on oil and we, you know, increased our puts on Exxon. And, you know, it took a few weeks to develop, but it basically played out exactly as we thought. We've now sold over half of our puts. And so we've doubled the amount of money that we already put in. So there's no way we've got stops on oil now. So there's no way we lose money on this trade. We will absolutely make money on the trade. It's only a matter of how much. And so, you know, it's kind of all gravy from here. And here's the thing is, if you think it's hard to sell oil when sentiment is really high, and it's at and it's the highest price in 6 months, and everybody's telling you not to do it, try to sell it now when it's down 10 bucks from where it was. And that's the thing, is like the hardest time to do the trade is usually the time to do the trade. And if you wait for it to pull back, now it's not a bad idea for it wait. It's not a bad idea to wait for it to peak, pull back a couple dollars, and then do it. I'm not saying that that's actually probably a better way to do it. But my point is, you don't want to watch oil go to 95, watch it pull back to 80, and then start shorting it at 80. And the other thing is that if you size your trades right, and if you structure them right, maybe you do them with puts so you have a limited amount of money you can lose, or maybe you put a trade on with a stop so that you get stopped out if it goes against you. I mean, I didn't know for sure we were going to be right, but I sized it in a way that if you lose money, you know what? Investing and trading involves losing sometimes. That's just the way it goes. I've gotten so many trades wrong, I can't remember them all. But you know, if the key is that you make a bunch of money when you got it right, and we did really well this last couple of weeks. We made a lot of money at short in oil, and we have enough protection, and we've sold enough puts, and we have stops in place now to where we're absolutely not going to lose any money on the thing. Now, here's where I think it gets really interesting with what you just talked about, because long term, I'm actually a huge energy bull. Again, there's one thing to have a medium to long-term thesis and then recognize that there's a short-term tactical opportunity to trade against that medium to long-term thesis. That was the idea for shorting oil. So anybody who says, you're crazy, oil's going to 300 bucks over the next couple of years, fine. I don't necessarily disagree with you. This is a short-term tactical trade in the other direction. But and when we heard the news that Saudi Arabia may increase production on Friday evening, we're like, wow, that could potentially be great for, you know, our oil short to continue profiting next week. Well, then the events of the last, you know, like you said, 24 hours, 12 hours. I mean, I got to tell you, I remain pretty level headed about stuff and don't get emotional, but this is just awful. I mean, it's just so bad. It's just this area of the world unfortunately, it's just, there's always like something under the surface. And unfortunately this stuff happens, and you know, I don't know whether it's going to be solved by Wednesday or this erupts into a much bigger event, but I think it has the potential to erupt into a much bigger event. But this means a number of interesting things for markets. My guess is that right now, and this is, we'll see when the markets actually open. If I had to guess what's going to happen right now, I would say that the markets will be volatile on Monday, Tuesday. Oil probably bounces. Again, I'm not convinced, but I think it probably goes higher. But it's very possible by Tuesday or Wednesday, oil's coming back down. And here's why. And I've said this many times. One of the worst things for gold over the last 10 years has been every time a military conflict pops up. Because every time a military conflict pops up, everybody runs in and buys gold. Gold pops $200. Everybody says, this is it. And then the military confrontation, for whatever reason, to whatever, you know, whatever you attribute it to, pulls back, dies down, the volatility comes down. You can start to see through the fog of war a little bit, and gold pulls back a couple $100. Same thing with energy and oil. You know, if you look back a year and a half ago when Russia invaded Ukraine, gold went to $2,100, oil went to $130, and a week later, gold was at $1,900 or $2,000. It had pulled back $100, $150, and oil was back at $110 or $100 because the war premium got priced out of the market. I think it's possible that same thing happens again here. Maybe we have a couple days of volatility and then it pulls back. And here's why it can potentially pull back. And now, this is not a prediction. I don't know for sure that this is going to happen. But I think part of the reason that it can pull back, and I'm kind of praying that it does, and you know, hope is not a strategy, but maybe there's a little bit of hope in this one, is that this is the type of an event that can cascade into not just a regional conflict, but a global one. And it kind of goes back to the mutually assured destruction thing from the 80s. You know, everybody, you know, both sides had enough bombs to blow up the other side 20 times over. And as a result, it kept conflict from happening. I kind of feel like this has the potential. Everybody knows this has the potential to escalate and escalate big. And because there's so much on the line, maybe cooler heads will prevail. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, we got these reports that Saudi Arabia was potentially going to, you know, increase production on Friday. I have a hard time believing they come out on Monday and say, we were just kidding. Right? When you're probably going to have oil going higher anyway, I doubt that Saudi Arabia is going to come out and say, nope, we were kidding. We're actually going to gut production and send oil to 180. Can they do that? Yeah, they can probably do that. Could that happen? Sure, that can happen. I don't think that that's going to happen. And the other really interesting thing about this conflict is, you know, for the last several years, 2 years, 3 years, we could probably measure it a number of different ways. But I think many people know we've been kind of moving towards this big potential conflict, East versus West, you know, global South versus the West, however, China versus United States, Russia versus the West, however you want to define that. And this is kind of a potential step towards that. And so it's the type of and especially because in many ways, there'd been a lot of progress made as far as regional peace. You know, the Israelis were talking to Saudi Arabia again. Iran and Saudi Arabia were talking again. There was some progress being made in the region, and sides were kind of being picked, but kind of in a soft way that everybody was going to try to work it out. So, but this is kind of one of those events where it can't just be soft and maybe we'll work with you. And maybe, like, this is the kind of an event where it's kind of you're with us or you're against us type of a thing, or it has the potential to become you're with us or you're against us. And I think there's a lot of people out there who are absolutely convinced that in such a case, Saudi Arabia would side with the BRICS or with China and Russia versus the West, and that Brazil would side with China and Russia versus the West. And I'm not convinced that that's the case. And I think you might see some of that play out over the next couple of months. And I think some of the results might surprise some people with regard to that. I don't think it's quite so easy for Saudi Arabia to just say, yeah, you know what, you're right. We're going to side with China and Russia on this one. And as a result, you know, everything's fine for them and everything's bad for the West. To me, this is a very big event. I saw somebody today refer to it. I saw it referred to a couple different ways. I saw somebody refer to it as Israel's 9/11. Saw somebody else refer to it as Israel's Pearl Harbor. I saw other people on the other side, on the Palestinian side, saying, you know, this is what years of, you know, living in an outdoor prison leads to. And, you know, listen, I'm not so smart enough to sit here and say I have the solution and figure it all out. All I know is that it's an absolutely horrible situation for all sides. And it's unfortunately probably not going to get solved real soon, but I hope that the volatility and the violence will get dialed down real soon.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, one of the first articles that I saw on the matter was, I believe, from Reuters, and I didn't quite know the extent of what had happened. It was just, you know, at that point, it was kind of the headlines that were being pushed through. But the first article I saw when searching for it was literally just a breakdown of what side people were choosing. All these world leaders, what their responses were, without even knowing the full extent of the event, that was already massively concerning. Like the red flags there were like, the focal point here is what's everyone saying about this? You could already see those lines being drawn. So look, as I mentioned, we try not to get political on this segment. This is more about, you know, the market impact. I think on a topic like this where we're, I'll speak for Brent and say generally we're not experts on. We're just really looking at it from the broader geopolitical impact to things that we've talked about so far in this episode, which is specifically oil, the oil price. Overall, economically, some of the things that we've covered in this episode I thought were very, very broad, but very, very necessary to get under and into the details a little bit on. We talked about some of the price action. We looked at non-farm payroll, employment data. We covered a lot in 40 minutes, and certainly an event that has just started, which has the potential to be a powder keg for so much more. We're not going to start leaning in and making bold claims, but clearly, as Brent has stated, there's certain alliances that potentially are going to be made. And when it comes to the oil price, the likelihood is that if Saudi Arabia was already talking about increasing production in the face of this event, it's likely that they stay true to that, if not increase further. But hey, that's why we show up. That's why we do the show. We don't know. We'll see what happens. But stay tuned for, perhaps we'll do a midweek update. We haven't done one in a while. I haven't really needed to. I mean, there's been volatility, but it's more data driven. We like to do the midweek updates when there's something maybe perhaps a bit more event driven. Maybe we'll have that opportunity this week. We will be doing a Monday peek at the week to give you a heads up of what's coming on the economic calendar in addition to some of this geopolitical tension. So stay tuned for that. And Brent, before I wrap up here, I mean, we've covered a lot. Is there any last little thing you want to throw in here before we call it an episode?
You know, the only thing I'm going to say is something that I've said before, and I'm probably going to say it every week for the next year, is, my God, this is just getting started. The next 12 to 24 months are going to be nuts. And, soapbox time, you've got to figure out how to get along with people you don't agree with, because it is not going to get any easier from here. And if you don't want to, you better start talking to them now so you don't have to fight with them later. And I really mean that. You got to figure out a way to stay calm and keep your head. You got to keep your head when everybody else is losing theirs. And I don't know the right method for you to do that, but you got to figure it out.
Well, my method is a really good Isla single malt. Whatever works for you guys, go ahead and take that path. But good words of wisdom. Hopefully there was plenty other words of wisdom in this episode. We appreciate all of you joining us. You can communicate and follow and engage with Brent on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can do the same with me on Twitter at John Katsmita. You can have a chat, follow along with this podcast at Milkshakes Pod. It's the same handle. You can find us on YouTube. That'll do it for our full length episode. Like I mentioned, come join us for the peak of the week and keep your eye out for a potential midweek update. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate you joining us. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.